welcome. This is Wildlife Wednesday, and this is a partnership between Alaskans for Palmer Hayflats and Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and we work together to bring you live presentations free to the community all about wildlife. And so if you're interested in our future presentations, I encourage you to go to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game website, and the easiest way to do that is just type in ABFNG in your search bar. And then when the Fish and Game website comes up, just search calendar. And right away, a community calendar will come up with all of our different community programs, including Wildlife Wednesday. Now, there is an Anchorage Wildlife Wednesday as well that happens once a month. We try hard not to coincide with their dates. But we have a December presentation will be a Fish and Game research biologist presenting on managing and research of the Mulchatna caribou herd. So that should be very interesting. Without further ado, we're going to get right to it. I would like to present our guest speaker tonight. He drove all the way on the icy roads from Anchorage, Mr. Todd Atwood. He's got a bachelor's and a master's degree in wildlife ecology and another PhD in wildlife biology. He moved up in 2012 to study and get closely acquainted with the infamous polar bear. So we're excited to learn all about that tonight. So please help me welcome Todd Atwood.
Thanks for the opportunity to come out. As Sierra mentioned, my name is Todd Atwood. I'm with the USGS Polar Bear Research Program. I've been with the program since 2012. And basically what we do is conduct research for Department of Interior agencies on polar bears in Alaska. So primarily we work with the Southern Beaufort Sea and the Chukchi Sea subpopulations. And what I thought I'd do today is start out with just kind of a general overview of our research program, a little bit of background on polar bears, and talk about some of the more pressing conservation issues for polar bears. So what I'll do is start out with a real quick introduction to polar bear life history, talk a little bit about the science that led up to the 2008 decision to list polar bears as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. I'll spend the bulk of my time talking about how changes in the Arctic are affecting polar bears. I'll provide a little bit of background on what's happened in Western Hudson Bay. I think that provides a good example for what we can expect to see, and in fact what we are seeing in the Southern Beaufort. And then I'll close with talking a little bit about what the future might hold for polar bears. Okay, so a little bit of polar bear life history. Polar bears are big. They are, on average, the largest land predator we have. Kodiak brown bears can get pretty big, but on average, polar bears are just a tad bit bigger. There's a fair amount of sexual dimorphism in polar bears, like most ursids or bear species. What that means is that there's a difference in size and shape and mass between the sexes. Males are considerably larger than females. Male polar bears can weigh up to 1,500 pounds, be 10 feet tall. And when we talk about tall, you know, that's kind of from top to nose, but it's really length that we're talking about. So they can be 10 feet in length from the tip of their nose to the tip of their tail. Females can be up to 500 to 600 pounds and 8 feet tall. So, you know, there's about a third difference in body mass between, or rather two-thirds difference in body mass between females and males. And it's pretty striking when you see females and males together during the mating season. It's very easy to pick out the males. They're, on average, about twice the size of the females. They're a long-lived species. In the wild, they can live into the late 20s, in captivity, early 30s. The oldest recorded bear in captivity was 41 when it died, and it was at the London Zoo. We see bears routinely in the early to mid-20s, and last year we caught a bear that was 28 years old, and she was in really good health. Polar bears are superbly adapted to survival in the Arctic, and in particular the Arctic marine ecosystem. They're really amazing animals. They probably split off from brown bears about 4 to 5 million years ago. That's around the time when we started to see the polar ice cap really lock into place. So they've had a long time to develop morphological and physiological adaptations to an Arctic marine environment. They're capable of depositing a really thick layer of fat. You can get a fat layer in polar bears during their prime time of feeding, which is generally the spring, that is up to 4.5 inches deep. They have really thick fur. It's not as dense as sea otters, but it's still really dense undercoat. They have black skin. The hypothesis is that adapted to allow them to hold heat inside the body. They've got webbed forepaws. They're excellent swimmers. And so they've developed these webbed forepaws that help them swim between ice floes, and in some cases probably help them stalk their marine prey when they're in the water. If you've seen videos of polar bears swimming between floes, kind of moving with their head real low to the surface of the water, almost like an alligator, they do that when they're searching for seals that are out on the floes basking. They've got small ears and tail, and this is one of the adaptations that we see in northern mammals that minimizes the amount of heat that gets lost to the environment. They've got an excellent sense of smell, a pretty good sense of sight, a pretty good sense of hearing, but really polar bears operate primarily off their nose. I've seen different studies that estimate that the sense of smell for most bear species is about 7 times greater than the sense of smell for canids. And, you know, they're carnivores. A lot of bears are omnivores. Brown bears, black bears, most of their diet is actually plant material. Polar bears are obligate carnivores. They can feed on some vegetation, but it's a rarity. And what they feed on is seals primarily. And in most of their range, they feed on ring seals and bearded seals. Their hunting style is primarily to ambush. They'll sit by breathing holes that seals put in the slushy ice, but they'll pop up every once in a while to breathe. And you'll see polar bears just kind of sitting over the top of a breathing hole waiting for a seal to pop its head up, and they grab it and pull it out and eat it. They will occasionally do some stalking in the water, swimming between floes, but primarily they're ambush predators. More and more they're becoming opportunistic as opportunities to hunt seals becomes less and less depending on how sea ice conditions are. One of the things that we're seeing in Alaska is opportunistic feeding at bowhead whale carcass sites that are created after subsistence whale harvesting in the spring and fall. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. A little bit about polar bear reproduction. They mate in April and May. That's the time of year when we're out doing our research, so we see a lot of mating activity. And females will often mate with multiple males. And typically what you see is what we do when we're looking for bears is we look for tracks in the snow and we cut the tracks and we start forward tracking those animals. And you can kind of tell female tracks because they're just a little bit smaller. And so if we cut some female tracks and start tracking her forward, inevitably we'll see 4 or 5 different tracks of males come in and converge on that female track. And it's not uncommon for us to capture a female and have 4 or 5 males in the area trying to kind of push us off of that female, which makes for some interesting animal processing activities. Every year we have 1 or 2 males that kind of sneak up on us and try and push us off their female. Like other bear species, they have delayed implantation of the fertilized egg. So it typically implants in the fall. And then the cubs are born in late December, early January. Really small when they're born, about 1 foot long, about 1 pound. By the time they come out of the den in March, they're 25 to 30 pounds. We've seen some cubs that are upwards of 40 or 50 pounds, but that's a pretty rare event. The mothers are real protective, like most bear species. And the cubs are dependent on mom for an extended period of time. They'll typically stay with mom for about 2 years. And once they hit that period of the second spring with mom will start coming into estrus again, and then she'll push those cubs away and she'll breed. So female polar bears reach sexual maturity at 5. They breed every 3 years, kind of like grizzly bears. That period when bears are between being able to spend time with mom and being sexually mature is really the survival bottleneck for them. So that period, we call them subadults, so they're 2, 3, 4 years old. that's when we see the greatest amount of mortality. So that subadult age class typically has a survival rate of about 30 to 40%. So you lose a lot of bears during that period. Why? You know, because they don't have the guidance. They don't have mom to rely on. So they're kind of like a bunch of teenagers just trying to figure out how to make a living. Imagine if you kicked kids out of your house at 13 or 14 and told them to fend for themselves. That's kind of what subadult bears are doing. The leading cause of mortality for subadults is starvation. Adults, on the other hand, barring, you know, really severe environmental conditions, generally have pretty high survival. Adult survival is usually around 93, 94, 95% per year. So it takes a lot to kill an adult. So polar bear habitat. What habitat type is critical for polar bears? It's sea ice. And I'll talk a little bit about why. Mainly, as I mentioned, you know, polar bears have spent the last several million years evolving in this sea ice ecosystem. The primary role that sea ice plays for polar bears is providing them a platform that they can get out over the water on and hunt seals. That's really the primary value of sea ice to polar bears. So sea ice provides accessibility to food. Not surprisingly, they're highly dependent on sea ice. As I said, that sea ice provides a platform for them to access seals. Without that sea ice, they can't hunt seals. They're not good enough swimmers to hunt seals. But sea ice also has some other values. I wouldn't necessarily say they're ancillary values, but they're certainly less important than the accessibility that sea ice provides. One of the things that sea ice does offer is a cost-efficient way to move around the landscape. When you've got a lot of good, solid, contiguous sea ice habitat, it's a nice platform for them to move on. The other part of the equation is the sea ice is moving itself. In the southern Beaufort, we've got this big prevailing current system that is called the Beaufort Gyre, and it moves in a counterclockwise fashion. So if you're a bear in Kaktovik, on the east coast of our study area, the east side of our study area, along the Yukon border, you could theoretically sit on the ice and at some point in time probably end up in Barrow without moving because of that cyclonic Beaufort Gyre. So polar bears in the southern Beaufort, when they're moving from west to east, they're actually walking on a treadmill. It also provides a substrate for dens. In the southern Beaufort, about two-thirds of the bears now den on land, about a third den on the sea ice. But more importantly, it provides a denning habitat for seals, for ring seals. And this picture here is a bear that's broken into a ring seal lair. Lairs generally form where ice flows kind of butt up against each other and create little tented ice structures. The Arctic sea ice is a highly dynamic habitat. Last year we had a pilot from New Zealand who had never worked in the Arctic before, and we mobilized a bear. He landed, and pilots generally don't do anything when we're working up a bear. They just kind of go to sleep. They park in the sun, and they go to sleep. And we take a GPS point when we landed, and we took a GPS point when we started the helicopter an hour later, and we had moved 7 miles. He kind of freaked out about that. Okay, so let's talk about what we're seeing in terms of changes to the Arctic. We know that the Arctic warms faster than the rest of the world, and the primary mechanism for that is the buildup of greenhouse gases. And primarily, we're talking about carbon dioxide. Buildup of greenhouse gases leads to increasing temperatures in the Arctic. What we see then is melting snow and ice cover, melting glaciers, particularly in Greenland, not so much in the Arctic part of Alaska. But all that translates into a loss of sea ice habitat. The Arctic Ocean's very dark. I mean, it's kind of like India ink dark. And so what happens is the ambient temperature rises. We see sea ice melt. It creates open water, this dark open water. That dark open water absorbs solar energy, which then creates more melting, which then opens up more water, which absorbs more solar energy. And we get this feedback loop. The overall trend for the Arctic is that sea ice extent is declining in the summer, and multi-year ice, the ice that's been around for years and years and years, is getting thinner. So this is a projection of what we've seen in terms of sea ice extent during the period of 2003 to 2012. There's a little contour right here. That's the continental shelf. And I'll freeze the frame here on that. The Southern Beaufort has a very narrow continental shelf. And the reason why that's of interest is because continental shelf waters, those are waters that are, boom, right there, that are shallower, are generally more biologically productive. So polar bear prey, seals, prefer those shallower waters. In the Chukchi Sea, we've got this really vast region of continental shelf waters. In the Southern Beaufort, we've got this little sliver. Once you go off of that shelf break, you go from about 300 meters of depth to about 3,000 meters of depth. So you get about 125 miles off the coast of the North Slope there, and you quickly hit really deep, unproductive water. So currently what we're seeing in the Southern Beaufort is that we've got a period of about 2 months where we're ice-free in the summer, and it's generally August and September. These show animations of modeled emissions for the mid-century. This is a stable emission scenario, meaning greenhouse gas emissions peak around mid-century and doesn't increase beyond that. This is unabated. This means basically we continue emitting greenhouse gases as we have been. And you can see that there's a pretty significant difference, especially between this and what we've seen the last 10 or 15 years. But if we go with just the stable emissions, we end up with a summer where we have 5 months ice-free. If we go with the unabated emissions, we end up with a summer where we're 6 months for ice-free. Now, this is just for the middle of the century. It's much more dire for the end of the century. We know with polar bears that around 120 days of fasting, they begin to starve at rates of about 8% for every week that you add on top of that. So once we get to this period, 5 months of ice-free, we're going to see a pretty significant rate of starvation among polar bears. You know, over the last three decades, we've seen some fairly dramatic changes in Arctic sea ice extent and volume. Extent, or the kind of aerial coverage of sea ice, if you're looking down at the pole, has decreased at a rate of about 14% per decade. Sea ice volume, that's thickness, has decreased even faster at a rate of about 27% per decade. Now, volume's an interesting thing because there are some parts of the Arctic where historically the ice has been too thick to actually be good polar bear habitat. And those are areas of the Canadian High Arctic called the Canadian Archipelago, where you've got a lot of small islands and channels in between these islands. And this multi-year ice gets bound up in there. And there are polar bears up there, but they're very low densities of polar bears. And the thought is that over time, as that ice thins, that area will actually become better habitat for polar bears. But that'll be kind of a transitory phase. I mean, it's thinning because of ambient temperatures. So at some point, it'll get too thin. So what does this mean for polar bears? Well, it means that they're a species of conservation concern. They're listed as vulnerable under the International Union for the Conservation of Nature Red List, so that's an international conservation group. And they were listed as vulnerable based on expected declines of 30% by the mid-century mark. So this was work done in the early to late 2007-2008 period, first decade of this century. They're also listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. That's because of an expected decline of 50% by mid-century, so that was a revision done from the IUCN assessment. Why are they expected to lose ground? It's a real simple story. It's just climate change, loss of sea ice habitat. With most species that are at risk, you know, they're at risk because of loss of habitat. The solution is generally quite a bit simpler. You designate a refuge, you put restrictions on land use, you protect the land. With sea ice, we can't protect that. And to protect it requires a global policy solution. So currently, it's estimated there are 20 to 25,000 polar bears range-wide. These are distributed over five Arctic nations, which are called the range states, and so they have treaty obligations for managing and conserving polar bears. So it's the U.S., Russia, Canada, Norway, Greenland, and who am I forgetting? That's it. These 20 to 25,000 bears are distributed among 19 subpopulations. You can also think of the subpopulations as management units, and that's what these delineations on the map are. These aren't necessarily ecologically or biologically meaningful designations, those management units. We know that individuals move between these areas, and we know there's a lot of gene flow throughout the entire polar bear range. This is more just kind of a way to organize bears that makes management more logistically tractable. In the U.S., we have two subpopulations, the Southern Beaufort Sea that we share with Canada and the Chukchi Sea that we share with Russia. So because those subpopulations, management units are not necessarily the best way to ecologically delineate polar bears, there is this option to move to ecoregions. And what ecoregions do are collapse the subpopulations into kind of intermediate spatial scale units, which are defined based on similarities between those subpopulations in sea ice dynamics and bear life history. And so, for example, in Alaska, the Southern Beaufort and the Chukchi Sea group into the polar basin divergent ice ecoregion. It's called divergent because this primary movement pattern of the Beaufort Gyre moves ice in this clockwise direction and pulls ice away from the coast during summer. This area here is the convergent ice ecoregion. It wraps around Greenland and down along the western side of the Canadian archipelago. That cyclonic movement pushes ice to converge along this edge. This is the archipelago in here, characterized by heavy multi-year ice. And this is the seasonal ice ecoregion. We've got western Hudson Bay, where Churchill is, and southern Hudson Bay down at the southern end. The seasonal ice ecoregion is the only ecoregion in polar bear range where coming ashore during summer has always been part of polar bear life history. That's because in this ecoregion, sea ice has traditionally melted away each summer. When that happens, bears come ashore. They would spend, historically, about 4 to 5 weeks on shore fasting until the ice returned in the fall. What we're finding is that the Southern Beaufort is now transitioning into that kind of seasonal ice regime, and the bears are changing their behavior to cope with that. Okay, so trying to be mindful of the timer. So let's talk about some of the changes that we're seeing in the Arctic ecosystem. And I thought it would be helpful to kind of frame this in the context of what we knew about polar bear populations prior to the decision to list them as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. So this is that map of the 19 subpopulations. And this is from a status table that's done by the IUCN Polar Bear Specialist Group. And they do this, they update the status table about every 4 years, where all of the polar bear experts that work in the different populations do an assessment of their respective population and determine the status. Is it data deficient, meaning we don't have enough information to know what's going on? Is the population declining? Is it stable, or is it increasing? So in 2007, we had 5 subpopulations that were declining: the Southern Beaufort, Norwegian Bay, Kane Basin, Baffin Bay, and Western Hudson Bay. We had 5 that were stable. We had 2 that were increasing. These are both in the Canadian archipelago. And we had all these here, these 7 that are unknown. They're data deficient. We don't know how they're doing. So 7 out of 19 subpopulations, we don't have a good handle on. At that time, we also knew that we were losing summer sea ice at a pretty good clip. This is a little bit of a busy figure, but these colored dotted lines are individual general circulation models. And what this is doing is using observed data to then project through the end of the century what September sea ice extent is likely to be. September is when the Arctic reaches its minimum sea ice extent. This thick black line here is the mean of all these colored dotted lines. So that's the ensemble mean. The thick red line is the observed sea ice extent. This is what we've observed off of satellite imagery. You can see that in 2007, the predicted extent of summer sea ice, September sea ice, was about 7.8 million square kilometers. And what was actually observed was just under 6 million square kilometers. So the take-home message here is that these models are not very good at predicting September sea ice extent. But unfortunately, they're underestimating the loss of sea ice extent. We were actually losing sea ice faster than the models had forecast. So in the lead-up to the decision to determine whether polar bears should be listed as threatened, we were asked to contribute a number of science products that could be reviewed to help with that decision-making process. One of the things that we did was project the persistence of polar bear populations through the end of the century. We did this at that ecoregion scale because information wasn't fine-grained enough to do it at the subpopulation scale. So what we did was take those general circulation models that project sea ice extent, and we projected sea ice habitat based on how we know polar bears select their habitat at different points in the future, the middle of the century, the late part of the century, and the end of the century. We did that for each of the four ecoregions. We used available data and expert panels to fill in the gaps in terms of vital rates and what we thought would be key stressors and threats to polar bears, how those might change through time. And we brought this all together in this modeling framework, which is called a Bayesian network model, and we won't worry about that, but it's a Bayesian theory, is a theory of statistical modeling. And we used that framework to project the probability of polar bear population response given what anthropogenic stressors they were likely to experience, what environmental stressors they were likely to be experiencing at those times in the future, mid-century, late century, and end of century. This is a schematic of the model. So, you know, what we're trying to do here is depict what the polar bear's world looks like and then quantify that. And the take-home message from that was the model projected a range-wide decline. By mid-century, there was probable extirpation in the divergent and seasonal ice ecoregions. And remember that the two Alaska subpopulations are in the divergent ecoregion. Together, that would represent two-thirds of the range-wide population of polar bears. By late century, there is probable extirpation in that third ecoregion where the sea ice converges. But the good news was that also by the end of the century, there was a probable remnant population here in the Canadian archipelago. And that's that area where currently it's not very good polar bear habitat because the ice is probably too thick. So what the models are saying is that as ice thins, this area will become better polar bear habitat. And in fact, it'll be one of the last areas to retain sea ice. And because of that, it'll be one of the last areas to retain polar bears. So let's take a look at our current state of knowledge. So this is that map from 2007, where we had the five subpopulations in decline, five stable, two increasing, and seven data deficient. Since then, we've seen Davis Strait go from being in decline to stable. That's good news. We've seen Lancaster Sound go from stable to being data deficient. We've seen Viscount Melville go from stable, or to increasing rather, to being data deficient. Norwegian Bay is now data deficient. And now we've got nearly half of our polar bear populations which are data deficient. So we've got a few changes here. We've got four subpopulations in decline rather than five, but we've got quite a bit more subpopulations where we know nothing about. We have no new information. Again, that's because of the logistics of doing that work. It's incredibly expensive to do this kind of work. And some countries don't have the resources. Some countries haven't made the commitment. How are we doing with sea ice? The short answer to that is not so well. We go back to our sea ice projections, and we look at that ensemble mean. The projected sea ice extent for 2014 was 7.1 million square kilometers, this black dot here. And actually, we're down here at a little bit over 5 million square kilometers. So, you know, we're continuing to lose sea ice at a really good clip. And if you play that out, that 5.2 million square kilometers corresponds to a predicted sea ice extent for the year 2060. So we've lost a lot of sea ice habitat. It's most dramatic in the summer. And it's been particularly profound in the southern Beaufort Sea. This is a real simple illustration, but I think it demonstrates just how dramatic the loss of sea ice has been in the southern Beaufort. The top panel is from 2003, September, again, when sea ice is at its minimum extent. We had, you know, maybe about a third of our area covered by sea ice. September of 2012, which was a new record low for sea ice extent, we really didn't have any measurable sea ice in the southern Beaufort, just a tiny little sliver. And so increasingly what we're finding as this open water season gets longer and longer is bears are changing their behavior. And one of the primary changes is coming ashore when there's no longer any sea ice habitat over the continental shelf. Now this is where Western Hudson Bay factors in. And so here's Western Hudson Bay. This is Manitoba. Here's the southern Beaufort. And this is kind of a weird spatial orientation. The southern Beaufort isn't really that far north of Hudson Bay. It's just the projection of the map here. But there are some lessons that we can learn from Hudson Bay about what will likely happen in the southern Beaufort. Hudson Bay has not been spared the drudgery of loss of sea ice habitat during the summer. In Western Hudson Bay, there's been a shift in the timing of sea ice breakup. Over the last three decades, it's now occurring about 3 weeks earlier, so about a week earlier per decade. With that, the folks doing research in Western Hudson Bay have seen a shift in the timing of arrival on bears, of bears on shore. They're arriving about 3 weeks earlier. That's been accompanied by a decline in body condition, for example, an 18% decrease in body mass. So that's 3 weeks less time that bears have to spend on the sea ice hunting their prey, which is very fat-rich, and then depositing body fat, which is very important for surviving that period where they're on shore for 4 to 5 weeks, and coming out of it in good enough condition, especially for the adult females, to have enough body fat to bring off a successful litter. That has been accompanied by a decreased survival rate, about 3 to 8% decline for each week that bears have to spend on shore extra over that 4 to 5 week mean. So in Western Hudson Bay, the changing sea ice phenology, the earlier ice melt, means earlier arrival on shore, declining body condition, poor survival, and declining population size. The population size of southern or Western Hudson Bay has declined by about 25% over the last three decades. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what we're seeing in the southern Beaufort. And I showed you a couple slides back that graphic of sea ice habitat in September of 2003 compared to 2012. And this is, I think, a little bit more of a detailed illustration of that. So we've got sea ice extents for the southern Beaufort and for the Chukchi. This is really for the polar basin. From 1980, 81, 82, and 83 on that top panel. And we're comparing that to 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010 on the bottom panel. So roughly about 30 years apart. These are all for September when sea ice was measured at its minimum extent. You can see the dramatic difference there. Substantial loss of September sea ice habitat. You can also see that there's variability between years. You know, it's not a linear decline. There's kind of ups and downs and ups and downs, but the trend is declining. And when we overlay those, it makes it real apparent the difference in sea ice extent. What I want to draw your attention to here is that in the 80s, except for a little part of the southern Beaufort in 1982, in the 80s, we had sea ice over the continental shelf. That's really important for polar bears. Since probably about 2000, we haven't had very much sea ice over the continental shelf in September. So what's happened in the southern Beaufort is that the traditional late summer sea ice habitats are gone. They just don't exist. What we did here is take a couple of those sea ice extents and put points from radio-collared bears, points that were collected in September of 1985. So these are all these yellow dots. These are all collared females. And when you put those point locations on the 1983 sea ice extent, all but one fall on that sea ice. And look at all this sea ice next to the continental shelf. Well, when you overlay those points on the September 2010 sea ice extent, maybe 5% fall on sea ice habitat. The rest would fall into open water. If we were to do that for the 2012 sea ice extent, which is actually right about there, a little sliver there, then none of those points would be on sea ice habitat. If we did it for 2014 sea ice extent, maybe about 5 to 7% would be on sea ice habitat. So we've kind of turned the corner in the southern Beaufort, and in my opinion, we've transitioned into a seasonal ice regime there. These are heat maps. Now, these are generated from radio collared bears. These are based on models of resource selection. The brighter colors indicate areas where bears are more likely to select habitat. The colder colors are areas where they're less likely to use. And if you look here at 1985 in spring and autumn, there's not much of a difference. There's a little bit more use up here, not so much here. But there's a lot of really highly used habitat in both of these maps. If we look at a more contemporary period, this hasn't changed that much. We still have relatively good sea ice habitat in the winter. This is where we've lost it. We've lost it in spring and summer. The ice-free period is getting longer each year. Breakup is occurring earlier year over year. Freeze-up is occurring later year over year. And that open water period is getting longer. So in ecology, we like to talk about when you have a major perturbation to a system, about cascading effects. It's kind of a buzzword. And what it really means is, what are all the things that kind of fall off of those major perturbations? What are the trickle-down effects? And in polar bears, we kind of think of those trickle-down effects as stress signals. Those are signals that this population is under stress. And it's kind of a sentinel system. These are kind of early warning signals that we're on the verge of seeing some major issues in probably reproduction and survival. One of the things that we're identifying as stress signals in the southern Beaufort is increased onshore abundance, earlier arrival onshore over time. Dietary shifts, becoming less reliant on marine mammal prey in the summer and perhaps more reliant on terrestrial resources. And with increasing reliance on that kind of terrestrial end of things, which is relatively new for southern Beaufort bears, we're concerned that they're going to be exposed to new risk factors. For example, health risk factors that they weren't historically exposed to, because the sea ice does kind of act as a functional barrier to a lot of infectious agents, for example. Well, one of the major stress signals that we've seen with polar bears in the southern Beaufort is an increased frequency of long-distance swims. Over the last 10 years, we've identified 50 long-distance swimming events by 20 collared bears. The mean distance of a swim event is 154 kilometers. So imagine swimming in the Arctic Ocean for 154 kilometers. These animals truly are remarkable. It's an amazing feat of endurance. When they're swimming, the movement rates are about twice the movement rate over pack ice when they're walking. Some of this is probably current aided, but you know, when they're swimming with the current at times, there's probably other times when they're swimming against the current. What's most interesting is that most of these swims are from low concentration ice or fragmented ice to either the pack ice in the polar basin or to shore. And what that tells me is that these bears are staying on the ice over the shelf as it becomes increasingly more fragmented. It basically melts out from underneath, and at that point they make the decision to either swim for shore or to swim to the pack ice. This animation shows an example of a truly remarkable effort by a bear. She was collared in 2008 at the end of August. She swam about 700 kilometers. So there she goes, she's right here, she's in open water, she's swimming to the pack ice. She has a yearling cub with her. And she swam for about 2 weeks until she reached the pack ice. When she reached the pack ice, she hung out there for a while. By the way, these other dots are other bears. And basically what she did was follow the pack ice back down to the coast. So this is her right here, the green. So we're seeing kind of the pack ice come back closer to the coast as freeze-up is starting. And she comes back into the area around Kaktovik. In about 2 months, she traveled over 1,500 kilometers. Almost 700 of that was swimming. She was captured again on October 26th. She didn't have her yearling cub anymore. She had lost 25% of her body mass. These types of behaviors are becoming a little bit more common. We see bears that swim from shore to pack ice. Okay, what's going on here? And swim from pack ice to shore. These long distance movements really spurred us to develop a study in 2009 to look at the behavior of polar bears summering along the North Slope coast. And we just wrapped up our field work last fall. And what we do each spring is we go out and capture bears. And we do these from helicopters. And we'll cut tracks. You can see some tracks here that we've cut. And there's a bear out there in the front end there. We spend about 6 weeks out on the sea ice capturing bears. We put GPS satellite collars on about 20 or so bears, and those are just adult females because males, their necks gets too big to accommodate a collar. And when we capture the bear, we generally have them in hand for about an hour, and we collect a ton of information from these bears. We do a lot of studies related to health, related to genetics. We invest so much in capturing these animals. These animals are so valuable that we probably have at least a dozen studies that each animal supports. So when we capture the bears, we're taking body measurements. We're collecting biological samples. One of the things that we've found is that bears in the southern Beaufort are decreasing in stature over time. They're getting smaller. We believe that's due to nutritional stresses. Polar bear cubs are the cutest thing on earth, aren't they? We've seen greater indication of fasting from the blood work that we do. We've seen decreased body condition from the work that we do looking at lipid content of fat tissue. We see populations that are a population that is having troubles. One of the things that we've noticed with our collared bears is this process of displacement from continental shelf habitats and movement on shore. So this image, these colored icons are individual collared bears. This image is from June. And this is right when the breakup season occurs. So we've got a lot of open water here in the Chukchi, breakup occurring in the eastern part of the southern Beaufort in Canada. And what that's doing is squeezing our collared bears into a tighter area where we still have really good sea ice habitat in here over the continental shelf. In July, breakup's in full swing. We've got some unconsolidated ice over the shelf, and some bears are still trying to make a living off of that. We've also got some bears, like these guys up here, that are committing to being polar basin sea ice bears for this summer. In August, breakup has run its course. We have no measurable sea ice over the continental shelf. Bears have been displaced from that preferred foraging habitat, and they've segregated. They're either going to be onshore bears or sea ice bears for the summer. So remember the Hudson Bay, arriving on shore earlier over time. We're seeing the same phenomenon in the southern Beaufort. On average, bears are arriving on shore about 7 weeks earlier. The only problem is, in the western Hudson Bay, they were arriving on shore 3 weeks earlier over three decades. In the southern Beaufort, they're arriving on shore 7 weeks earlier over 10 years. We're seeing a change in land tenure, or the amount of time they spend on shore once they do arrive. Early 2000s, a lot of variability, no real clear pattern. We hit 2006, we fall into this lockstep increase a greater amount of time spent on shore. In 2006, bears spent on average a little over a month on shore. In 2013, about 53 days, and almost doubled over a period of 7 years. Our aerial survey counts indicate that we're seeing a greater proportion of the population come ashore through time. In the early part of the 2000s, 2000 to 2005, we estimated about 4% of the bears were coming ashore. We estimate that it's now closer to 14%, so it's almost, my graph is off, it should be 16%. It's basically quadrupled over a period of 10 years. Now, we have to take that at its face. So we've got 16% of the population coming ashore. That means 84% is still out on the sea ice. So it's not as dire as you might think. The problem, though, is that there's a trend here of increasing proportion coming ashore through time. And there's only so many resources on shore for these bears to rely on. And we'll talk a little bit about that. So the big question is, why are they coming ashore? And I think the reason why they come ashore is because they're evicted off the sea ice. Some bears, though, choose to stay on the sea ice as it goes into the polar basin. We generally believe that there aren't a whole lot of foraging opportunities. The blood values that we're seeing for bears that spend the entire summer on the sea ice indicates that a growing majority of them are fasting. For the bears that come ashore, though, there are some fairly significant resource subsidies, and mainly it's in the form of these bowhead whale bone piles. So there are three whaling communities along Alaska's North Slope: Barrow, the village of Nuiqsut, which whales off of Cross Island here in Prudhoe Bay, and then the village of Kaktovik. Each fall, they go out, they hunt bowhead whales, and they strike a whale, they bring it back to shore, they butcher it, and what they don't use for subsistence purposes gets aggregated into bone piles. Whaling typically occurs in September. This is when sea ice is at its minimum extent, and we have a lot of bears on shore, and so these bone piles are focal attractors for polar bears, and really for anything else that's looking for a very fat-rich meal with little investment in foraging, little investment of energy. So we get a lot of polar bears. We also get brown bears. We get foxes. We also get a variety of scavenging birds. This is what you tend to see at the bone pile. So this is an aggregation of polar bears. Polar bears, by their nature, aren't very social. And it's kind of odd to see this kind of salmon stream-like aggregation of polar bears. What's really funny is you can have 20 polar bears feeding in a bone pile and a single grizzly will come in and scatter them. A grizzly half their size. So they're still learning to kind of cope with their terrestrial competitor. So you get large aggregations of polar bears around these bone piles, and it's a little bit unusual, and it's kind of aggregating them in a small, confined area, and with that comes some risks, but we'll get to that in a second. The point here is that those bone piles really are the key to survival for some of these bears. These photos show a couple of bears that showed up just outside of the Kaktovik bone pile. This bear here, this is the same bear here. You can tell when they've made a long distance swim because they're very white, their coat is very white. This guy was spotted coming right out of the water. This is an emaciated adult male. You can see that he's lost even muscle mass over the skull. So has this bear, lost a significant amount of muscle mass. This guy made it. He fed at the bone pile for a couple of weeks, probably packed on several hundred pounds. This guy never got up. What we're seeing with these bone piles is that polar bear diets are diverging in the summer. We've got our bears that hang out on the sea ice in the polar basin for the summer. They feed primarily on ringed and bearded seals, although we think they're feeding at a reduced rate. This line here shows the diet of those polar bears over this time period. So it runs from right to left. And these are stable isotope signatures of prey items detected in polar bear hair samples. And you can see that we're right around this 21.3, 21.5 range. That's indicative of those sea ice bears feeding on ring seals, bearded seals, year-round. These white dots are our nearshore bears, our onshore bears. These are the bears that we've detected at bone piles. They start this spring period feeding primarily on seals. And then when we get into late summer and particularly early fall, we pick up this depleted nitrogen signature, which indicates that these guys are switching to bowhead whales. So we've got this major behavioral divergence occurring in the southern Beaufort, where a small proportion of the population is coming ashore during time and they get evicted off of that continental shelf habitat, and their diet's changing for that period of time. We're also seeing some indication that this is being accompanied by declines in health, and this is one of the concerns that I have with the bone pile, that it aggregates these animals in a confined spatial area for an extended period of time. It exposes them to different types of risk factors that they would likely be exposed to if they were on the sea ice. In 2012, we had the alopecia syndrome, the hair loss syndrome. That occurred alongside a similar syndrome in ring seals and Pacific walrus. Didn't appear to be lethal, although it's hard to tell. We did see a number of bears in subsequent years that have recovered from the alopecia. We never found out what caused it. There were a number of hypotheses, but so far nobody's been able to figure out what caused it in polar bears or seals. We also, for the first time, detected the bacterium Coxiella burnettii in polar bears. This is a zoonotic agent that moves back and forth between animals and people. It's real common in vets, so if you know a vet who especially has a large animal practice, they probably test positive for Coxiella burnettii. It's primarily a livestock disease. We picked it up in polar bears in 2013, which makes it the northernmost extent of Coxiella. How it got there, we don't know. We know that it's in northern fur seals and the Pribilofs, but that's a long way away from the southern Beaufort polar bears. Coxiella can be serious. It can cause spontaneous abortion. And so there are potential population level implications regarding reproduction. In general, there's evidence of increased exposure to health risk factors. So we're looking at Coxiella, Brucella, Toxoplasma. We've got a baseline here of prevalence rates for the mid-2000s. Coxiella was 3%, Brucella was 6%, Toxoplasma was 12%. We ran samples just recently for 2013 and 2014. We found Coxiella went up by a factor of 9. Brucella tripled, Toxoplasma almost doubled. Now, it's important to note that this doesn't mean that they're infected or diseased. It just means that they've been exposed. The type of test we're doing is measuring exposure. But it does beg the question of why have we seen an increase in exposure? Well, let me answer that for you. When we went back and looked at the seropositive bears, we found that a little over two-thirds of them are known to be regular visitors to bone piles. So it indicates that there's something about this use of terrestrial habitats that might be increasing the risk of exposure to infectious agents. Okay, so what does the future hold for polar bears? Well, here's where we're headed. In the summer of 2013, the White House released the National Strategy for the Arctic. And the core message of that is to balance economic gain with conservation. And there are a number of countries that are kind of positioning themselves to take advantage of the open water season, and primarily to take advantage of the ability to extract resources for a longer period of time during these lengthening open water seasons. And it's becoming something of a, you know, kind of an open season on where national boundaries start and end in the Arctic. There's a lot of discussion about who owns what part of the Arctic, and I think this is going to intensify in the next 10 to 15 years as transnational interest in Arctic resources increases, and it is increasing rapidly. One of the things we've done at USGS is develop this program called the Changing Arctic Ecosystems, which devotes several million dollars a year to research focused just in the Arctic ecosystem, both the marine and terrestrial ecosystems. Where we're headed as a program is trying to understand the effects of changing Arctic on bear health. So not just disease, but what makes a bear healthy, what makes it unhealthy. How does that link into changes in population performance, population persistence? We want to determine the capacity for polar bears to adapt to these conditions to show some resilience. I'm not talking about genetic adaptation because we don't have enough time for that. You know, we need to characterize the energetic consequences of this increasingly fragmented habitat that they have to navigate. And we want to improve our ability to project population status in the future. There are a number of emerging stressors, one of which is increased transarctic shipping. These are projections of likely transarctic shipping routes for the near future, for mid-century, straight through the Northwest Passage. If that opens up, we're going to see a lot of shipping activity in the Arctic. And polar bears aren't the only thing to kind of be concerned about. Bowhead whales, ring seals, be a lot of concerns over shipping through the Northwest Passage. Increased resource extraction. These dots are polar bear locations in the Chukchi Sea. This outline here is the Chukchi lease sale area. That's probably where we're going to see the first offshore drilling in the Chukchi. But it's also an area that's used at least seasonally at a high intensity by polar bears. And so we're going to have to think about how to manage that. With increased resource extraction activities, we're going to see increased exposure to the products of that activity. These are two bears that we found on an island in Prudhoe Bay in 2012. They were exposed to a chemical, rhodamine B, which is not known to be highly toxic. It's what caused the pink staining. It stains tissues pink. They also had a fair amount of glycerol in their system, which is used as a groundwater tracer. So in a nutshell, what we're seeing is that loss of sea ice is triggering a fairly profound change in the Arctic, particularly in the southern Beaufort. In response, we're seeing the emergence of these divergent behavioral strategies. Do I stay with the sea ice as it retracts into the polar basin in summer, or do I come ashore? Who's making the right decision there? We don't know, but that's going to really be a key to how well this population does in the future. It could be the coming ashore is adaptive in the short term, but as we get more and more bears coming ashore, eventually the value of those bone piles isn't really going to be what it is now in terms of a forage subsidy. And all of this is occurring in kind of this greater international context of intense pressure to develop the Arctic. So most projections, sea ice projections, indicate that the Arctic will likely be ice-free in summer by 2040, perhaps as early as the 2020s. And by ice-free, they mean less than 1 million square kilometers of sea ice extent, so not an absence of sea ice totally. The future of polar bears? Well, right now the future of polar bears is that by the end of the century, hopefully we have polar bears in the Canadian archipelago. But the future of polar bears isn't written yet. That's the exciting thing about this. The future of polar bears is really in our hands. And I think we have to collectively make the decision. Do we value a species for what it represents? This isn't really about polar bears. This is about our changing planet. Polar bears are just kind of an early warning system to what we're likely to experience outside of the Arctic. They're feeling it first. It's coming our way. So thanks. I appreciate you coming here this evening. I always love to talk about polar bears. Thought I'd leave you with some fun pictures that make me smile when things get a little bit too depressing on the polar bear and things. So thanks.